Welcome, everyone, to episode 395 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and we have a lot to cover today. We're going to talk about the NBA being on fire, Bradley Beal trade rumors, and what's wrong with the New Orleans Pelicans. Before we get into all that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. In our bio, you can find our Twitter handles, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. We are being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. And we are recording our show today on Locker Room, the only live audio social network for sports fans. Listen to our show on Locker Room before it hits your iTunes feed, engage with us in real time, or start your own room to react to the draft, trade news, and more. Take the mic and download Locker Room in the Apple App Store. Joining me today, as always, is a guy who probably isn't as mad at the NBA as I am, Morten Jensen. How's it going?
It's going well. Why shouldn't I be mad at the NBA?
They didn't force your favorite team to play two bullshit games, so...
Oh, I don't have a favorite team. But that said, that is true. But, I mean, I'm still an NBA fan, observer, pundit, whatever you want to call it. So I am absolutely upset at the fact that the 76ers got forced to play. That was a load of hooey.
That's good. Yeah, we'll get into that in a second here. But before we do, just a reminder that we are being supported by Manscaped. If you want 20% off and free shipping, use the code NBAPOD, that is NBAPOD, at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com and use the code NBAPOD. Your balls will thank you. And you know what? Yeah. I won't be sending a package to Adam Silver. I hope he has an unruly mane down there because... Because more, we have to, unfortunately, I mean, I think this is the big story of the NBA over the past couple days is the league is just on fire with COVID. Last time we recorded was Friday, and it was before we knew Seth Curry had tested positive. We did not know the extent to which contact tracing would deplete the Sixers. So it ended up, there were seven guys questionable for contact tracing. Three of them ended up getting cleared. Joel Embiid, Danny Green, Paul Reed. Ben Simmons, Joel Embiid both sit out of Saturday's game against the Nuggets, as do the four guys who are on the COVID list, plus Seth Curry, who has COVID, plus a couple guys who are hurt. So they ended up only having seven healthy players for that game. They list Mike Scott as active, although Doc Rivers says he's not going to play. You know, they are competitive for a quarter and a half and get their brains beat in for the rest of the game. Same thing happens Monday night against the Hawks. Embiid and Mike Scott return, so they have nine healthy players. Whoop-de-doo. Again, hold their own for a quarter and a half, then get their brains beaten in. And the Sixers are not the only ones dealing with COVID complications. Miami-Boston was postponed on Sunday. Boston had the minimum eight players required to play a game, but Miami did not because of contact tracing protocols. Avery Bradley has tested positive, and they were sorting out who was a close contact to him. New Orleans-Dallas got postponed Monday because Dallas didn't have enough players. And then Boston and Chicago, which was planned for Tuesday, also got postponed Monday because Boston doesn't have enough players. Despite all of this, Woj reported Monday that the NBA is not planning to pause the season. There is a meeting today of the Board of Governors, so maybe we'll find out, you know, something with regard to their plans moving forward. But more, what do you make of the last 4 or 5 days of the NBA? Like, what should the league do here?
They should take a 2-week hiatus at the very least. I actually think it should just go to February 1st, and then that's actually about 2 weeks, roughly, a little bit more, and basically reset. And while they're resetting, put in more protocol, because I think ultimately, if the virus, you know, squeezes through these NBA organizations, they had to figure out where does it happen. Where is there a weak link? They can't recreate a bubble system like they did in Florida, but I think they can take certain precautions that they might not be doing now. And I'm saying that fully realizing that I'm not into the planning of an NBA team, but I just cannot imagine that every single team is doing, you know, 100% of everything they can do, and every possible avenue is sealed off. Mm-hmm. I just can't imagine that being the case. So I think for them, this could be a period where they reset everything. They just go into this whole 2 week thing where we go, let's see if we can close any hole whatsoever that allows this to fester, and let's reattack this season on February 1st, and then go from there.
Yeah, I mean, I hear you. It does feel like we're hurtling toward a short pause, just because, I mean, we now have four teams in the Sixers, the Heat, the Celtics, and the Mavericks, who can barely field a competitive roster. Right. Even, you know, like the Heat and Sixers hypothetically have two games against one another this week on Tuesday and Thursday. Thursday is nationally televised. Jimmy Butler, Bam Adebayo, and Goran Dragic are among the seven players who have been ruled out for contact tracing for those games, along with, you know, Avery Bradley is the one who tested positive, and I think it's like Maurice Harkless, Casey Okpala, whatever, right. It's role players. But we're talking about a Heat team that's going to be like Tyler Hero, Duncan Robinson, and garbage. And then a Sixers team that has four of the nine players healthy are rookies or guys on two-way contracts. Five of them are bigs. Like, it is just an embarrassment of a product to be televising. There is no reason to be holding these games. And, I mean, you know, from the Sixers' perspective, it really sucks because these games count in the standings. Like, this is not, you know, and we've lopped off 10 games of the season already. Like, these are just completely unnecessary games to be played right now. I mean, I thought the whole point of having, you know, they released the first half of the league's schedule because they knew situations like this would happen that would require postponements. It just feels gross to make a team play with only eight or nine players. It's like, who's watching that game?
Yeah. No, I do think people will tune in, but I think a lot of people would tune in over the same like ideology of why you would tune in to Sixers Nuggets just to see the absurdity of this situation. but that's not a good product. I agree with you. Like, yeah, maybe people tune in to see just how bad is this thing, but that's not a selling proposition. That is not an asset for the league. I agree.
Right. I mean, I was excited to watch Sixers Nuggets a few days ahead of time because I was like, oh, cool, Embiid Jokic. This is going to be the first real Sixers test of the season. And then all of these...
Jokic kicked his ass.
Yeah.
Because Embiid put up an egg.
Yeah.
There was no stats recorded whatsoever.
Yeah, Jokic really owned Paul Reed. Congratulations, yeah. Nikola. You know, it was nice to see Tyrese Maxey in a featured role, I guess. So there was like some morbid curiosity there. But
oh, come on. That was not, I guess. That was fantastic.
Yeah.
That was one of the funnest rookie games that we've seen over the past few years. Come on now.
I mean, he had no choice. He's the only guy on the team who could actually dribble and shoot right now. It's ridiculous.
Right. And it was fun as hell.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it would be fun if it was like a preseason game and it didn't matter. But the fact that these games actually have some implications for the playoffs or for home court advantage, that's where I start to get a little annoyed. And then, you know, against the Hawks, Embiid was just dominant for the first quarter and a half. And then he just got fed up. Like, you could just see him on the court because, you know, he was passing out of double teams, but the guys he was passing to just could not hit shots. Danny Green was awful. He had no trust in Dakotas Mathias, which, of course, he didn't. He's a rookie on a two-way contract. So then Embiid started taking on, like, quadruple teams. It was just a joke. And Doc benched him early in the second half because they have, theoretically, have another game against Miami. So it feels...
Wait, are you telling me that Danny Green displayed inconsistency?
Well, when he's the number two option on the team, it's a little different when he's the number five. And, like, there is one play where Joel Embiid and Dwight Howard ran a dribble handoff. And Dwight Howard dribbled to the basket and just absolutely whiffed on a layup, like, was 5 feet away from hitting the rim.
Okay, that needs to go on Twitter. You have to go find that clip and put it on Twitter.
Oh, it's already on there. I'll send you the link. It's just an embarrassment, though. And as much as I hear the argument for a two-week pause, I'm not 100% convinced that it's going to fix anything. That's where I'm struggling with this, because my fundamental question, dating back to pre-bubble, and I don't think we have an answer because I just don't know how you test this, is whether someone is contagious before they can test positive. Because if that's the case, no amount of precautions that the NBA could take is going to completely prevent the spread here. Like, they're doing, you know, two tests every day. But if someone can be contagious for a day or two before a test is registering them positive, I don't know that's what happened with Boston and Miami in particular, but the timeline would at least add up where Tatum played, I think it was on last Wednesday, the Heat and Celtics played. Tatum test positive, I believe, Friday or Saturday. Avery Bradley test positive shortly thereafter.
Right.
So I'm not saying this is what happened, but I think it's a question that the NBA needs to answer. Because
if they can,
right,
if they can,
right, yeah. And I don't know if they can, but
no,
that's my concern here, is that we can take as many pauses as we want, but until the guys are vaccinated, it might not matter. I mean,
I know where you're heading. Yeah, I know where you're heading with this.
Well, I mean, before we get there, I will say, Sham Sharania of The Athletic did have a report out yesterday about some of the protocols that the NBA could tweak, which you mentioned earlier, where they're talking about, you know, there have been meals with four or five players and others present. That's risky and unnecessary risk at this point.
Yes.
Outsiders interacting with quote unquote tier one members, rival teams sharing meals with each other in a home city. Maskless conversations are happening in close proximity on the court after games. So I think there are areas the NBA can address and tighten up.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why Bradley Beal got ruled out, because he spoke with Tatum after the game, and then Tatum tested positive the next day, and Beal was out for one game there. So, yeah, like, there are definitely places that the NBA can address, but I think it still goes back to the fundamental question of, when are guys contagious? When do they test positive? Which one happens first?
Right. Oh, boy. I mean, that is just such a tough road ahead, because you need to be a sports league that's, you know, essentially ahead of the curve from a medical perspective.
Right.
You're not. You're a sports league. So, and then comes the question, I'm going to raise it. You said we should hold off. I'm going to raise it.
Yeah.
You know, should the NBA skip the line for vaccines? Should they get preferential treatment, and should they be prioritized over a lot of different people to getting the vaccine? And no, it's a sport, it's entertainment. Like, you know, I'm fairly certain, if I, you know, follow the news in the US correctly, that there are like a army of medical professionals who have yet to receive the vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
And we are going to delay the vaccine to them because we want sports and entertainment.
That's argument, yeah.
Yeah, no. Look, and here's the thing. I'm relying, this, you know, both you and I, we are in the sports business, mm-hmm. both you and I.
Right.
We work in sports, indirectly so, but it's still in the sports business. So it would behoove our interests that the league continues to soldier on, that they do get this, you know, beneficial treatment, and they skip the line and everything, because then we have something to talk about. Then we have something that goes round and round and round. But look, the ethical matter here is just so much more important. Look, the optics it's one thing about the optics, but here's the real life component. What if the people that the NBA players would be, you know, skipping over, who could be in a worse risk field, so to say, because they're not, you know, professional athletes. What if those people die,
right,
or at least some of those people die?
Right.
then you would be looking at the NBA as having blood on their hands. And they would have blood on their hands if they demanded it. To be fair, though, I don't think I've seen anywhere that the league is demanding to skipping the line. So I'm not going to go all the way, you know, that route. If they had demanded that, that would have been an entirely different discussion. But no, I don't want to see branches of entertainment be prioritized if it could risk people's lives. It would just be completely insane. Like, at a scale where it need to be global headlines.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the NBA, dating back to the preseason, has been very explicit that they do not want to skip the line. This is more a conversation that's been happening on NBA Twitter the last few days, and because NBA Twitter is an echo chamber, I've seen a lot more support than I have people saying, no, they should not. And I get the arguments for it, right? I mean, people are saying it'd be 500 vaccines. It wouldn't be 500. It'd be more than that. It'd be, you know, every traveling party has roughly 50 people, so it'd be 1,500, which in the grand scheme does not sound like a ton. And, you know, the other argument is, like, because vaccine rollout in this country is so screwed up right now, some hospitals are being forced to waste doses because they just don't have enough people to take them, and that, you know, they have a very limited shelf life, especially I think the Pfizer one only has 5 days or so. So, you know, I understand the arguments for, but, you know, I can only speak to, my wife is a doctor, a lot of our friends from her residency program are doctors, so I can only speak to their experiences. My wife's hospital, they have not vaccinated everyone in that hospital yet. I think they have gotten through the tier 1A, which was 6,000 people, and these are people who come in direct contact with COVID patients frequently. And that's not just doctors and nurses. That's also janitorial staff, cafeteria staff, you know, people who are coming into those rooms every day. So great that those people are vaccinated. The rest of the hospital staff is not yet. Now, if that changes in the next few weeks and we start rolling out vaccines more widespread to people 75 and older, 65 and older, essential workers, people in grocery stores, teachers, firefighters, first responders, then the NBA can skip the line over me. You know, I'm extremely low risk. I work at home. I wear.
That was a humble brag.
Wow. Well, I'm just saying, I should be very much last in line for this, and you know, people.
I'm not as fat as you, Mort, so I'm good.
No, I'm just saying.
I don't have sleep apnea, you fat bastard.
I have very few comorbidities that would raise my risk if I do get COVID. So I guess
I could actually play in the NBA right now. It's just because I don't want to.
I mean, the Sixers need bodies at this point. Yeah.
But, well, you know what you would be? You would be the guy on the court with the most the best smelling balls.
Yeah, there you go. And I'd probably be their third best shooter too.
Right.
But no, I mean, I think there's an argument that the NBA should be ahead of some cohorts of people, but absolutely not ahead of doctors. Absolutely not ahead of people, elderly people who are being more at high risk, or essential workers. There is no good argument for it other than we just want our entertainment. Like, I saw someone say, like, it'll keep people at home so they can watch the NBA. That's
Oh my God.
I just could not. I was like, you cannot be serious with this.
That's some mental gymnastics right there.
Right.
Wow.
It really, really is. It's like, that is just objectively untrue. No one's going to be like, oh, well, I was going to go out to a bar that's not open tonight, but instead I'm just going to stay home and watch the NBA.
Yeah.
No.
Let me put it this way. I would be upset if the NBA got passed over to, like, let's say an outbreak happens because of what happened at the Capitol and all the terrorists, I'm going to say the word, got the vaccine before, you know, sports leaks and whatnot. That I would have a problem with.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think the NBA, once they widen it beyond elderly and essential workers, I think the NBA will be next in line ahead of people like me who are, you know, relatively young, not in super risky situations, because the NBA is...
Okay, Fabio.
Well, the NBA is riskier than you know, people who have been working from home. That's like, there's no argument against that. But no, the NBA should not skip the line ahead of everyone like that. So it's going to be, you know, we're probably talking at least the next 6 weeks or so that the NBA is going to need to navigate this before vaccines do get rolled out to that extent. And, like, hopefully, I mean, you know, we have Pfizer and Moderna are both approved in the U.S. AstraZeneca, which has been, I believe, approved in the U.K., and now the EU is looking it over as well, the Oxford-AstraZeneca one. Johnson & Johnson is also in the works. I think they're hoping to release data by the end of January. Hopefully both of those work. Hopefully they get approved. Hopefully we have, you know, a higher supply and, like, the vaccine distribution. I know it's a big focus of the Biden administration in their first 100 days. They're hoping to roll out 100 million shots. You know, they're now saying we don't need to hold back the second dose. Let's just get shots in arms and figure out the rest later. So, like, the picture could look very different in a month. But right now, it's pretty bleak for the NBA. And I just don't know what they can do. I mean, again, they'll tighten certain protocols, I'm sure. But I feel like really this first half of the season is probably just going to feel like an extended preseason at this point.
Right. well, so you said about 1,500 people. That would just be, you know, traveling parties.
Right.
There's more than that, to give the full picture, because teams come back home again, and then you have all the staff working from home. You still have arena employees, not vendors necessarily, so that number grows exponentially real quickly. So there is so much more to it. But I agree. If the people who need it most gets it first, then I don't have a problem whatsoever with the NBA getting it. Like, that's fine. That's obviously the way it should be. I'm just not sure, like, what the situation is over there, because you hear so many different things. For example, like you said, Some vaccines are just basically going out, you know, unused because they don't have enough people and this short shelf life. And, like, yeah, I'm just at that point where let's see what it looks like in a month or 2 months. Like, right now it's just bad, and we shouldn't work on the presumption that, oh, it's automatically going to improve. Like, be proactive. If there's something this pandemic has taught us, or should have taught us, it's, hey, while we figure stuff out, maybe just don't be an ass. Like, right. Just act logically in the meantime. And then when we get things figured out and we can return to normal, then you can become an idiot again. It's fine. Just put on your smart thinking cap until we have this figured out.
Right.
It's not difficult.
And the one thing to bring it back to basketball terms, and this will segue into our next topic as well, the one thing I was thinking about yesterday was, you know, assuming the next 4, 6, 8 weeks are like this, where teams are playing with 8 or 9 players and playing games they have no chance of winning. Like, again, hopefully things are better in March, April, May, and, like, we have full strength rosters, relatively speaking, once the playoffs roll around. But do you think, if you're a general manager, does this affect how you're approaching the trade deadline? Like, are you less willing to make a blockbuster trade in this season of all seasons because you're just like, this season is FUBAR? I don't even know how you could plan for, you know, like, we're not going to give up our entire team for James Harden because who's to say we're not going to get contact traced out of the playoffs?
Well, so basically, If it's a blockbuster that puts me and my team in a situation where I can win the title at any point over the next 5 years, then no, I do it. And even if I have to cancel a ton of game or propose a ton of games as a result, okay, you know what? I'll live with it. Now, to me, that's not James Harden. Mm-hmm. That's someone who's probably not available or who's definitely not available, like a Nikola Jokic or a Luka Doncic or players of that ilk. But that's unrealistic because those guys aren't getting traded anyways. So given the current market, given the current players that are in the market, no, I would agree with you. No, you probably won't. And I think it's more than that, actually, to be honest with you. I think also you have to think about the long-term thing. If I'm a general manager and I'm looking to shake up my team, I'm actually keeping a list somewhere of players who have had COVID, and I am debating with my medical team, you know, we don't know the long-term repercussions. Are we going to, should we just trade for a guy not knowing whether he's going to develop lung issues or heart issues? You know, I forget his last name. Johnson,
I think, right? The
was it Johnson?
Kid, the kid Johnson, from Florida?
Johnson, yeah. Florida, yeah.
Yeah.
That was really, really scary, man.
Yeah.
I saw that video. He collapsed like a rag doll. And then it comes out that those heart issues are connected to him having had COVID previously.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if that doesn't scare the living poop out of you, I don't know what does. So if I'm a general manager and I'm building my team, I would absolutely look at guys who've had COVID and who haven't had COVID. And I would, I'm not saying I would rule them out necessarily, but I'm saying I would be having very, very many chats with my medical staff and my training staff and everyone who knows anything about the human body.
Yeah, my broken brain actually went the opposite route when you first said that. And I thought you were going to say, I would see which guys have had COVID. I would target them because in theory, if they recently had COVID, hypothetically, they'll be protected from getting it again. So that is one
fewer
player.
Well, not that
player.
Dumb, man.
Yeah. But that, I mean, we saw in Shams' report yesterday, one player has tested positive twice within a year. So that theory even goes out the window. But yeah, it certainly adds yet another factor that we have to take into consideration, if nothing else, as we approach the trade deadline. But again, like, hopefully things are looking a lot less bleak in 2 months, and maybe it will be, you know, a more normal trade deadline where, you know, by that point, hopefully, like, vaccine rollout will be to the point where the NBA has all gotten their first shot so far, and, like, we can reasonably expect the second half of the regular season to go off without a hitch. But I just think right now, especially, if, you know, if teams are already thinking about trades, I just wonder how that factors into the equation.
I agree. Well, on to some lighter news, Brian. Oh, wait.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, on the trade note, we have to talk about the Washington Wizards, Mort. The Wizards are 3-8. They did just beat the living hell out of the Phoenix Suns. 128-107 on Monday, but Thomas Bryant is now out for the year with a torn ACL. Russell Westbrook is out for at least a week with a quad injury, so they did beat the Suns without both of those guys. But Kevin O'Connor of The Ringer wrote a story Monday morning that said Bradley Beal watch has begun. You said the Wizards are in disarray. Teams are thirsting for a blockbuster trade and are increasingly shifting their gaze toward Beal. As always, the Wizards have been famously reluctant to deal him. But, I mean, prior to that win over Phoenix, Beal started to sound really frustrated with how things are going in Washington. I think, you know, he said something like, we couldn't guard a parked car right now after the, I think that was after the game Friday against Boston. And, you know, he dropped 60 against the Sixers last week. And after the game was like, man, it doesn't matter. Like, I just want to win.
Yeah.
So more on the state of the Wizards, what do you think they should do? Should they start quietly shopping Beal, just to not to necessarily say we are definitely going to trade this guy, but at least get a sense of, if we were willing to trade him, what sort of offers can we expect?
Of course, they should have done that over the past year. I mean, getting offers and shopping aggressively are two very different things. And having a list of offers doesn't hurt you whatsoever. And just having a finger on the pulse in terms of what can I get for this guy? Yeah, they should. Of course they should. And also, somebody save my man, Troy Brown Jr., from this organization.
Yeah.
Even with Russell Westbrook out, he's getting DNPs. You may make fun of me and my Troy Brown Jr. love, but you cannot tell me that that guy is a DNP player.
No. I mean, lurking under all of this is that Scott Brooks has been doing just an abysmal job this year.
He's checked out. I think he's checked out.
Yeah, I mean, I would think if we're talking about guys on the hot seat so far, Scott Brooks would be the top of my list.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree. I don't think he's done a good job this year. I'm not really sure why that is. I think sometimes as well, we always talk about maybe players just get burned out in mm-hmm. certain teams. I think the same goes with coaches. I don't think there's a difference there. They haven't had a lot of success, and they haven't had sustained success. So I don't think a coach looks at that situation and goes, oh, yeah, I feel very confident in where we are now and where we will be in 5 years.
Right.
No. And so I think it might be time just to hit the big old reset button. And Beal can fetch you virtually everything you need.
Yeah.
I mean, in theory, at least, he can get you salary relief, he can get you young guys, he can get you a myriad of draft picks. You already have a very interesting young core if you played them.
right.
So, and of course, pending that Thomas Bryant returns healthy next year, which, God, that was just such a blow.
Yeah.
So, here's my Thomas Bryant slight hot take. I think he was on an all-star path. Not this year, but I look at that guy, I see his offensive versatility. He could have been an all-star in a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's going to take maybe a year to 2 years to get back. Like, this year's lost.
Right.
Then next year he's going to come back and he's going to have to get reacclimated to the speed of the NBA game, meaning he's not going to be at full strength. And then, it's the year after that he's going to be picking up where he is right now, or where he was right now. Like, while the ACL is not a death sentence anymore in terms of NBA careers, it's still 2 to 3 years of your NBA life that's essentially shaved off.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very worried about his future progression in that sense. But no, Beal, I think there are so many teams out there that could use him, obviously. But the question I have is, which good team, has the assets to give up what the Wizards are looking for? Because most good teams have already exhausted trades, and like in terms of giving up draft picks. The Bucks can't do squat. They gave up everything for Drew.
Mm-hmm.
The Lakers can't do anything because they gave everything up for AD. Who is out there? The Clippers gave everything up for Paul George. The best teams, they just don't have the assets anymore to go for a Bradley Beal.
Yeah, KOC said, teams already widely known to have interest in Harden, such as the Nets and Sixers, would unsurprisingly also have interest in Beal.
Right.
Most people said Brooklyn is a fairly unlikely destination since it doesn't have a high value player or an asset. Again, going back to the Harden talks, Brooklyn had a much more appealing package before Dinwiddie got hurt, but it's some combination of LeVert, Prince, Jared Allen, Dinwiddie, however many picks you need. The
right.
Sixers, if they're willing to part with Ben Simmons, that's just like in the Harden stuff. Ben Simmons is probably the best single asset or player you're getting in a superstar trade. He also asked 14 front office executives which teams came to mind for a sleeper. 6 said the Pelicans, 3 said the Heat, 2 said the Knicks, and Mavericks, Nuggets, and Spurs each got one vote.
Well, you mentioned the one team that I want him on, but they too don't have the assets.
The Mavericks?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They just don't.
Yeah.
I really love, the Mavericks structure, even though they've struggled this year. But where are the draft picks? I think you can, if you're an NBA fan, you're listening to this podcast, you want to go on 2K or you want to go on Trade Machine, you want to do whatever, and you want to test out Bradley Beal trades, like, cool. But have this in mind. If a team doesn't have the capabilities of forking over a treasure trove of NBA draft picks, that's a non-starter.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the because they traded 2021 and 2023 for Kristaps, right?
Yeah.
Do they have 2025?
I believe so. I'm not sure. Let me see.
Because, I mean, what the Wizards could do if... I mean, again, you're right. It's tough to find the high-value asset beyond that unless they're including Kristaps, which kind of defeats the purpose.
They have their 2025, yes.
Okay. So, like, they could do 2025 and 2027 unprotected, 2024, 2026 pick swaps, or even 2022 pick swap. Mm-hmm. So, and, you know, teams are starting to get smart about that and bank on implosions where, you know, if you're trading Bradley Beal to a good team, hypothetically that team's going to stay good for a while. So you're betting, you know, and in 4 or 5 years, that's where things start to get a little dicey. Although with a, you know, a Mavericks team with a 21-year-old Luka Doncic, that's a probably a losing bet. Yeah. But I mean, yeah, it's tough to see a pathway for Dallas to beat all other offers on the market.
Agreed.
Yeah, I mean,
but he's like that's the team though. Like we can sit around and talk about Miami, we can talk about the Pelicans and blah blah blah. Like no, that's the team right there. Having Beal alongside Luka, taking the ball more so out of Beal's hands as a shot creator and more as a guy who runs off of Luka. Like good lord, that would be good offensively.
Well, I could say the same about the Nuggets. With Beal and Jokic.
The Nuggets is good. The Nuggets is a really good bet. But the thing is, though, and I've been harping on this, they lost so much talent, I wonder if they have the assets now.
Yeah.
Like, this is where a Malik Beasley, who was re-signed, like if they hadn't traded him, he would have been a trade asset. He could have been included in that package.
Yeah, it would have to be, I mean, Michael Porter Jr. would have to be the
big chip. Oh, absolutely. And good for the Nuggets if that happens. Good lord.
Right. And then, I mean, for the salary ballast, it probably has to be Gary Harris, who, prior to being exhumed against the zombie Sixers, he'd been horrible to start the year. Like, we talked about him earlier this year. I don't think he has a ton of trade value, if any. You know, maybe not negative, but not substantially positive.
No, I will give him this. He actually seems, over the past week or so, he seems to have gotten a little bit more lift.
Yeah.
He played really well against the Sixers. I understand that was the zombie Sixers.
Right.
But even so, like, he looked way more fluid on his jump shot. That was good to see. That said, you're right. He still doesn't have positive value. But okay, let's look at it from Denver's perspective. It's Gary Harris at $20.5 million. Then you add in Michael Porter. You probably have to give up the kids as well. So a guy like Archie Hampson, Bol Bol, Sik Naji, like some of those guys you would have to give up. The rights to Marcus Howard, I guess, as well, just because, you know, he's a high-scoring guard. PJ Dosier as well, who's actually been decent, and I told you so. Like, you would have to give up all those guys, and even then, it becomes a question of roster spots.
Right.
Like, how much can Washington even absorb? Do you need to get another team involved? Like, there are so many questions there. But that's the starting point. And that's not even to say, like, the picks, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Is that even realistic, though? Would the Wizards even go for that?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, probably not. If Ben Simmons is on the table, I think that's the route they would prefer.
Yeah.
If he's not on the table, I mean, the Heat are also lurking there. You know, for all the concerns we had about a James Harden trade for the Heat, I don't have those concerns for Bradley Beal.
Like, I would agree.
I mean, they can offer, you know, Tyler Hero, Duncan Robinson as the main chips. You know, I'm going to come back to this point as we get closer to the trade deadline. But with Duncan Robinson, I just can't help but wonder. He's really, really good. This is not anything against Duncan Robinson. But I can't help but wonder if the Heat are looking at how much money Joe Harris got in free agency this past offseason, knowing that Duncan Robinson is a free agent this upcoming year, and if they're just like a little bit gun-shy about, like, okay, we're going to have to shell out, realistically, probably $80 to $90 million to re-sign this guy.
No, they are. They have to. I can't imagine they won't be.
Right.
So he's better. He's better than Joe Harris.
Yeah, and like I'm not saying that Duncan Robinson doesn't deserve that kind of money, but that's just going to lock them into that court. Like that eliminates their flexibility moving forward.
Right.
Are they willing to make that gamble, or should they be proactive? Like if you trade Hero Robinson salary filler to Washington for Beal, does that make you a better team?
Miami, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It does. He's a, this is a, you're talking about a guy who's currently averaging 35-5-5.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it makes you better.
And I mean, from Washington's perspective, maybe they aren't super interested in Duncan Robinson because maybe they also see, like, either A, we don't want to pay this guy as much as he's going to get, or B, we think he's just going to walk. We don't think he has any interest in re-signing with us. So, like, it'd probably have to be built. Like, Hero would have to be included in that deal as well. I don't think they could only include Duncan Robinson, but...
Oh, good Lord. So they would have Hero, Duncan Robinson, and Davis Bertans running around the perimeter. Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
Oh, my... Wizards, do it. I would love to see that.
Russ should literally never be allowed to take a shot. It should just be like, just drive and kick every single time. Do not ever shoot the ball.
Yeah. Or shoot the ball on drives, just don't take jump shots. Right.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, there are interesting offers there. And here's my question in a vacuum, where, and maybe it's team dependent, so it might not have a straightforward answer. But if the cost is the same, if you have to give up the same amount of picks, players, whatever, for James Harden or Bradley Beal, which guy would you be going after if you were running a team?
Oh, you know my answer to this. Come on.
I do, but I mean, I'm with you. So you would go Beal over Harden?
Of course.
Younger, frankly,
I mean, just more level-headed. Acts more professionally.
Yeah, and I think he's more malleable in terms of his fit. Like, if you acquire James Harden, you have to mold your entire team around his style of play, where I think Beal is more of a plug-and-play type of player.
Yes.
I mean, the argument against it is that James Harden is a better player than Bradley Beal, which I think is a fair point. Like, you can't discount that if we're just going by talent, in a vacuum, James Harden's better. And, you know, this was a topic of conversation I saw on Twitter yesterday, which is why I bring it up here, because I think there were more people in the Harden camp than the Beal camp, and a lot of people in the Harden camp are like, are you effing insane? This isn't a contest. But I think it is, because I feel like a lot of discussions about trades end up pretty reductive in terms of, like, let's just amass the most talent together and figure out the fit later. Like, let's just pretend this is NBA 2K. It is not. We saw that strategy with the Sixers last year, and it backfired miserably.
Yeah.
Fit matters. And, you know, finding guys who can play alongside one another, that actually matters. Harden next to Butler and Adebayo versus Beal next to Butler and Adebayo, I'm taking Beal 100 times out of 100.
Yeah. Of course I am. Yeah, I am too. And it's not just the age. I don't think... I do agree that Harden is better, but I don't think the talent gap is so big that I would just bank on the extra talent that I'm getting in there. Because...
Mm-hmm.
Again, I'm also getting a guy who's four years younger?
4 years,
Okay, three or 4 years younger. And like you said, he's a guy who's actually willing to play off the ball a little bit more. Let me just look up a stat. I looked up one of them, and Bradley Beal is assisted on 44% of his shots.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking up Harden's right now. I don't know.
Yeah, I was wondering about three-pointers.
3-pointers. So Harden is assisted on 29% of his threes. I don't know if we should use this year, though. Is that unfair? You know what? Then we're starting from scratch here. 2019, I'm going to find Bradley Beal's 2019 as well. Because then we forego the small sample sizes.
Right.
Oh, my good Lord. So this gets worse. James Harden, overall, in the regular season last year, was assisted on just 15.3% of his field goals.
Wow.
And on his threes, only 18.9% were assisted. Okay. So, and Beal last year, this is pretty much in line with this year. He's assisted on 45% from the field, like overall.
Mm-hmm.
And on threes, he's assisted 63.5% on his three. So, but here's the kicker, and this is what I like. Just because Beal is assisted on 63.5% of his threes, that doesn't mean he's like he needs to be set up, because is still, you know, 36.5% that he creates by himself.
Right.
That is over a third of his threes, and he's a high volume 3-point shooter that he creates by himself. And but I like the idea of having Beal in a system where he isn't the be all end all offensive option.
Right. Like, yeah, he is not strictly a catch and shoot player. He can very easily create off the dribble for himself, and he's got a nice little mid-range game as well. Like, this is not saying Bradley Beal is Duncan Robinson, where I don't want him creating off the dribble a ton.
Right.
But yeah, like you, I prefer a guy who doesn't necessarily need the ball in his hands at all times to succeed. Like, a guy who can play with, you know, because most of the teams that we're going to talk about in terms of a Bradley Beal trade have at least one other established centerpiece, whether it's Denver with Jokic, Miami with Butler and Adebayo, Philly with Embiid, Dallas with Luka. Like, you're not going to take the ball out of those guys' hands 100% of the time just to feed James Harden. With Bradley Beal, you don't have to.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I think it's at least closer than people, you know. I get the arguments for Harden as well, but I don't think it's a blowout either way here.
No, but it's an interesting debate, right? Because you always talk about, like, how you want someone to be a primary playmaker, and then you want to have players to play off of that guy. So if we go back to our previous discussion about Luka Doncic and Nikola Jokic, you know, James Harden wouldn't play off of those guys. He would come onto that team and force those two to play around him, mm-hmm. which you would have to change the entire ecosystem, because currently the Denver and Dallas' ecosystems have been built up around Luka and Jokic, respectively. So you don't want someone to come in and disrupt that balance. You want to find someone who comes in and goes, oh, you know what? I can play off of you. Right. I understand what it takes. Like, if Nikola Jokic grabs a defensive rebound, takes two dribbles, and he sees someone leaking down the court, like a Bradley Beal, he's going to make that pass. Beal is going to have the trust in that pass. Whereas if that's Harden, like, okay, Harden is going to be standing right next to him, like, give me the ball, I'm going to set it up. Go.
Right.
Go. And then go stay in the corner, because I'm going to take a step back. Like, I understand the talent argument, but let me ask you this. Is self-awareness in NBA context a talent?
Russell Westbrook is my answer.
Right?
Yeah.
But if we put that to the test, if we put that into the equation of everything, then we could argue Bradley Beal, because of potential fit, is thus a more influential and thus quote-unquote better NBA player than James Harden.
I mean, I think he is. Like, I don't think you can argue that James Harden to date has been more productive than Bradley Beal.
Agreed.
But again, when you're looking at which guy should I prefer acquiring for my team, I think you're right that it's going to be a much easier fit to just slide Bradley Beal. You could be more confident that Bradley Beal coming onto your team, you don't have to redesign every single thing.
Right.
I just looked this up. So these are also stats from last year. So James Harden, only 5.6% of his 3-point shots were catch and shoot. And he mm-hmm. shot 41.2% on those shots. A grand majority, actually, no, he took 1.3, let's do it that way, 1.3 catch and shoot threes a game. He shot 41.2%, which is great. 10.9 pull up 3-point attempts per game. So a grand majority of his 3-point attempts are him dribble, pull up, step back. And that shot's very difficult to guard. He shot 35% on those. That's great. Bradley Beal was almost the split completely down the middle. 4.4 catch and shoot attempts per game. He shot 38.2 on those. 4.0 pull-ups per game, shot 32.9. And keep in mind, the talent he was playing with last year probably did not help his shooting percentages very much.
It did not, right.
So that's what I come back to. And this is basically, you have to ask yourself, is this a product of the system that they're running in Houston? And can James Harden play a different style on another team? Or is he just so used to things working this way? And have we seen him butt heads with now three different co-star teammates in Dwight Howard, Chris Paul, and Russell Westbrook? Is this just who he is? I mean, I think you're right to raise the self-awareness question. Yep. Of, is he willing to change the style he plays? I know Howard Beck has been harping on this for a while, and he just wrote, I think his first column at Sports Illustrated was...
Oh, really? I totally missed that. Good for Beck.
Yeah, I think it was his first one. Or it was like, they have this daily cover now, and he wrote a story basically about, like, is this who James Harden is, or if he goes to a different team, is he willing to make the sacrifices he needs, change his style of play, and have a shot selection that looks more like Bradley Beal's, where he's willing to, defer off the ball more and serve as more of a catch-and-shoot threat, where, again, like, it's a small sample because it's only 1.3 attempts per game, but 41.2% from three. Like, he shot much better on catch-and-shoots than he did on pull-ups. Mm-hmm. That's how you make him more lethal. So if he's willing to do that, that puts another chip in Harden's argument. But, I mean, you're right to go back to the age thing, too, because, like, both of these guys can opt out in 2022, and who would you rather max out at that point? 33-year-old Harden or 29-year-old Beal?
Yeah. Right. I mean, it's self-explanatory.
Yeah.
One thing we should note is the Raptors have frequently been mentioned as, like, a low-key Beal destination.
Mm-hmm.
Beal and Lowry share an agent.
Oh.
I'm just saying.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I guess OG, but the Raptors really kind of screw themselves with him because he's a poison pill guy now.
So he's probably, it's probably going to be Siakam, right?
Yeah, well, and then at that point, the Wizards already have Hachimura and Denny.
Right.
Like, forward is not, that's the one area where they probably feel pretty good about their future moving forward.
There's a different fun subplot about the agent here, because the Beal's agent is Mark Bartlestein.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a guy who's... the Bulls have done him favors over the past 15 years under Garpax. It would be fun, though, if Arturas Karnišu was just said, you know what? I've had to clean up a lot because they did you a ton of favors. Now it's time to scratch my back.
get a Zach LaVine, Wendell Carter Jr. trade going here?
Something along those lines will probably have to. Yeah, I mean, yeah, because it's, and then picks, right? Like, I can't imagine otherwise. Yeah,
for sure.
No, but I don't think, honestly, I don't think the Bulls should do it, but I just think it's fun because whenever I see the name Mark Bartlestein, I just immediately go back to all the favors that the Bulls did him over the years. So my point is basically this. Keep in mind who players' agents are.
Yes.
And, like, look at the track record as well. Because that matters.
Very good call. But the Bulls are always, they should be on the periphery of all. Not that they are in the front running for any of these guys, because frankly, I don't know if they're at a point where they should be making this kind of all-in push for a star.
Nope, but they shouldn't. They should be looking at a different wizard.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, they at least have some talent that should be of interest to other teams. But
right. And by the way, I'm referring to Troy Brown Jr., of course.
Of course. Yes. But okay. We will move on from Wizards postmortems from now, because I'm sure we will revisit these conversations as we get closer to the trade deadline. Let's instead turn our attention to the Atlanta Hawks, who we briefly touched on last episode when the Sam Amick report came out about John Collins calling out Trae Young. Right. And, I mean, things have gotten kind of bleak for Atlanta. They started 4-1. We were all feeling pretty good about that. Then they lose four straight. Cavs, Knicks, two against the Hornets. They beat the zombie Sixers on Monday. Woohoo. Bogdan Bogdanovic is now out with an avulsion fracture in his right knee with associated soft tissue inflammation and a bone bruise, per Shams. The Hawks say they're going to release a timeline to return later this week, but Jeff Stotts of Inside Street Clothes said he's probably out for at least 4 to 6 weeks. Danilo Gallinari, their other big free agent signing, is out for a few weeks with an ankle sprain. Chris Dunn underwent surgery on his ankle in late December. He's set to be reevaluated this week. So basically, I mean, we were super high on the Hawks in their offseason, and now most, if not all, of their big offseason signings are currently sidelined. Are you concerned about the Hawks? Like, were we too high on them? Were we too quick to anoint them as...
No, that's not fair. That's not fair because, you know, when you go into a season, you don't presume that a roster is going to be depleted by injuries. Mm-hmm. Like, if all of these guys were healthy, we'd be looking at it differently. Like, right now, and I brought this up on Twitter as well, Solomon Hill is averaging 17.6 minutes per game. He's not good. there's no way he should be averaging those minutes, so those minutes would go away. You know, Danilo Gallinari and Bogdan Bogdanovic, pending full health, would have gotten those minutes. Chris Dunn as well, part of that. So it's about who's playing compared to who would have played, assuming you know, guys were healthy. Like Brandon Goodwin is averaging 15 minutes a game. Would he have played? I presume not. So, and remember, Onyeka Okongwu, mm-hmm. also injured, has not played this year. They have lost a lot of bodies, and I think it's unfair to say, oh, we were wrong about them, because we just haven't seen them healthy. Like, were we wrong about them being a successful team this year? Yes, after context, after mm-hmm. the context of injuries, yes. But I'm not going to blame myself for making a bad call because I don't think it was a bad call. You know, situations just came up and it's unfortunate. Just in terms of like the Trae Young, John Collins situation, you know what? I don't think John Collins is going to return next year anyway, so I'm not really too caught up about that. My problem there, or my concern rather, is the relationship between Trae and Lloyd Pierce more than anything. Yeah. That's the thing for me, but we also know how NBA organizations handle these type of things. They fire the coach.
Right.
They're not giving up a franchise player, and they're probably going to follow suit here if it comes to that.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, I mean, I mentioned Scott Brooks earlier leading my hot seat rankings. I think especially, you know, prior to Monday, Lloyd Pierce definitely would have been number two on my list, but if you look at Atlanta's upcoming schedule between now and the end of the month, they're about to go on a 3-game road trip: Phoenix, Utah, Portland, then Minnesota, Detroit, Minnesota, and Towns is back, then at Milwaukee versus the Clippers versus the Nets, and then they wrap up the month with at Washington. So not a ton of, you know, at Washington versus Detroit should be wins. They should at least split the Minnesota series, I would think, as well. But other than that, not a lot of, you know, you're circling this game as a guaranteed win on the schedule here. Right. So, yeah, I mean, the Hawks, especially given their injuries, if, you know, if Gallo can't come back anytime soon, with Bogdanovic probably realistically out through mid to late February at the earliest, you know, the Hawks might be digging themselves into a pretty deep hole here.
Right.
I think this is
a team. This is a team that could greatly benefit from what we talked about 40 minutes ago about a 2-week hiatus.
Yes, very much so. And I think you're right to say that it's unfair to say that we were too high on them, because you can't anticipate that all of the things we were excited about with them their offseason would get injured in the first couple weeks of the year. You know, it's Right now, they're basically the same Hawks from last year plus Clint Capella, which is a 500 team. Mm-hmm. But
now him, we can talk about.
Yeah. What have you seen out of him so far?
I have seen him be less involved than I thought he would be, at least offensively. I think I've seen him not be as refined as he used to be in Houston because he's just not finishing shots. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, it's in a small sample size of 8 games, but he seems rusty, like proper rusty. And I don't, like, I'm not going to sit here and go, oh, the young Capella is gone forever. No. But it's been a rough start. This is a guy who used to shoot like in the mid-60s, who actually was getting fairly competent at hitting free throws as well, mm-hmm. while also being a devastatingly good rebounder, a good shot blocker, like a guy who could just do all the big man things. And so far, he's just seemed a little bit out of place. And I wonder if he's getting the ball enough. I wonder if he's getting the ball in the right spots when it, unless of course it's an oop, then you know it's an oop. I want to see him get set up just a little bit more, and I want to see them prioritize him getting easy baskets just to get a confidence level up as well, because mm-hmm. it's rough. It really looks rough.
Yeah, he got just in that Sixers game, he got off to a pretty rough start against Embiid, but toward the end of the second quarter in particular, he and Trae Young combined for like 3 lobs in a row, it felt like. Like they really started to establish some nice pick and roll chemistry. I mean, I think it's just going to take time for those two guys.
Yeah. But more than that, though, they played 2 games against the Hornets.
Yeah.
He combined for 14 points. He shot 3 of 8 in the first game and then 2 of 6 in the next one. This is against the Hornets. Look, right. who do they have at the 5, right? Bismack Biyombo.
Yeah.
And then PJ Washington is playing spot minutes. That should be like lunch.
But Clint Capella has never been that type of player, right?
He's never been the
guy who's going to create on his own. It's like he's completely dependent on Trae Young.
Of course, but Trae Young is one of the best passers in the league. So that's what I'm saying as well. Like, I want to see him get some good shots as well. I think it's a confidence thing, but even so, like he's so nimble. Like when he was in Houston, he would move around. He would make all sorts of dives and cuts that were very calculated. So when he came up against, you know, bench players, which I think, even though Bismack Biyombo was starting, I think it's fair to say that he shouldn't. That he would dominate his own opponent in that way. He would find ways to just outproduce you. He would find a way to just win that matchup. And he just hasn't.
Yeah. I'm sure part of it is just a matter of getting used to Lloyd Pierce's system, developing chemistry with Trae Young in particular. And
playing again.
Right, exactly. Just shaking off rust. So I'm not super concerned about Capella's fit. I mean, like, conceptually, I think he still fits well, and, you know, he's not gonna, we never thought he would be like the unicorn big type who's gonna stretch his range and start draining threes. That's just not his game, but he does provide some value in his current role, and I think he's only gonna get better from here.
Yeah.
The guy I'm a little nervous about, at least to start the year, is Cam Reddish, who really started to turn it on at the end of last year, but he is shooting 34.9 overall and 28.8 from three this year. It's just, again, it's early. I don't want to overreact too much, but just something to keep an eye on there, because I really did think he was finding his own. You know, he got off to a really rough start last year, too. So maybe he just doesn't like playing basketball in the winter, and maybe once it's the spring, he gets better, but I don't know.
He does seem like a guy who starts off slowly and then will finish years on a high note.
Mm-hmm.
Just a little bit. But I will say this. It's such a small sample size just in terms of his shooting. And he's got a pretty good stroke. You can also see he's hitting his free throws. So theoretically, that should transfer over and make him a better three-point shooter. But no, you're right. Like, it's... he should have been better at this point than he is. So it comes down to, is this just, you know, sophomore slump? Is it just him dusting off rust? Like, what is it? But, right, it's worth keeping an eye on.
Yeah. So, Mort, let's wrap up with another team who I'm not necessarily pounding the panic button yet, but right. I am wondering why they aren't better than they have been so far.
And I have an answer for you, so I look forward to this.
Oh, okay. All right. So that's the New Orleans Pelicans, mm-hmm. who are 4-5, and their game against Dallas got postponed. So they've beaten Toronto twice, San Antonio, and OKC. Excusable losses against Miami and Phoenix. The loss to Indiana in overtime. Lost to OKC is not great. Lost to Charlotte is also not great. So what do you think is going on with the Pels this year, Mort?
So I don't know what's going on internally, but mm-hmm. I think it's pretty, like when you watch them play, I think it's pretty apparent that they have some shortcomings. They're not moving the ball a whole lot. The ball is it's sticking. They're not hitting their threes. They're not even getting up threes when you look at the numbers. And something I just recognized right now, which it cannot help, but that's not something I admittedly registered when I'm watching games, is they're actually one of the worst free throw shooting teams in the league. That came as a surprise to me because that's not something I picked up on, but that can't help them. But the very mm-hmm. fact that they're not, you know, moving the ball as much as they should, they're not getting, you know, 3-point shots of high caliber. That is just such a problem when you play in the Western Conference. You have to play quick. You have to play decisive, and they're not playing decisive basketball. Lonzo has regressed as a shooter, it seems, at least from last year. Mm-hmm. Last year, he actually broke out. He had a pretty good shooting year. And even though his stroke looks better, you have to wonder what's going on there offensively. So defensively, he's actually been a beast. I'll be willing to say that. Like, Lonzo Ball defensively has just been outstanding. I have no problem with his defensive effort whatsoever. But I do wonder where the rest of his game is. He's just not getting into the open court as much. He's not moving the ball as he used to be. Like, we're talking about a guy who has a great court vision, and it's just not being put to the test whatsoever. And I wonder why that is. I don't have a good answer for you in terms of why that's happening, but it is happening, and it's a big problem. Now, Zion is interesting to me because we always talk about like how Giannis should get a 3-point shot, right? Because, mm-hmm. then he fixes everything. And the same conversation is starting to pick up around Zion. Now, I don't necessarily disagree with that, but I think for him, it becomes a question of actually improving his passing. Because when you watch them play, you'll notice just the insane level of gravity that there is towards him. Like, the entire court just kind of compounds onto him. Like, just he's a right. magnet. And that means shooters are open constantly. And he needs to do a better job of finding them. He needs to do a better job of understanding, okay, like, when I take one more dribble into the paint here, I'm going to have 3 or 4 guys basically collapsing on me. So I already now have to survey the court and see, where's Brandon? Where's JJ? By the way, JJ Redick has been absolutely horrible shooting the basketball. I don't know what that's about, so we can get to that. But like, he has to take that next step of understanding, where are my teammates mm-hmm. at on the floor, and when do I get rid of this thing? Like, sometimes he just gets too big of a tunnel vision. And look, he's, what, 20, 21? So I'm not going to sit here and panic about that. I think he'll get there. I also think it's unfair to put up his like 1.3 assist rate, as some on Twitter have done, because he's definitely better passer than his assist rate indicates, and he does pass more than that. But I want to see him become way more unselfish in that regard. I want to see him become not a pass-first player, but someone who balances shooting and passing almost equally. He would be so devastatingly good if you could add that passing element to his game. So those are some of the concerns. Eric Bledsoe is also a concern of mine. He hasn't been playing all that well, I think. He's become that player, if you catch my drift when I'm going to say this, he's sort of become a slightly irrelevant type of guy. Even though he was really good in Milwaukee, he does get stats. Like, you just always sit there afterwards and go, did he really have an impact?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's fair.
I think it is. Yeah, I mean, I was going to go back to Lonzo for a second and just kind of ask, like, are a lot of these struggles because they swapped out Eric Bledsoe for Drew Holiday this year? Like, was Drew Holiday the perfect type of player to play next to Lonzo Ball, whereas, you know, the Lonzo-Eric Bledsoe combination is not as effective?
Yeah. No, I mean, you gave up a guy who in the Eastern Conference probably would have been an NBA All-Star over the past 3 or 4 years, right?
Yeah, I think so.
So yes, absolutely. You lost a hell of a talent. And you're trying to replace it with a guy who, you know, in Eric Bledsoe, who's, like, what, a fraction of what Drew is as an on-ball creator, even as a shooter. I know the percentages right now is actually in favor of Bledsoe, but I think Drew's three-point shot, like, in isolation, was always a little bit miscued because he could still knock that shot down. Like, if you saw how defenses guard him compared to how they guard Bledsoe, mm-hmm. it's different. It's right. not the same caliber of defense that's being played. So the three-point percentage is misrepresented here. People just don't, you know, prioritize guarding Eric Bledsoe. And they do Drew Holiday because he can get into the paint, he can drive, he can shoot. There's really nothing he can't do. So, yes, absolutely, good call.
Right. I think defenses are more concerned with Bledsoe. They're going to goad him into shooting. They're more concerned with cutting off the drives.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with Drew, they know he is equally potent as an on-ball creator, but also a shooter, both on and off the ball.
Right.
I mean, I think he's just more comfortable playing in the off-guard role than either Bledsoe or Lonzo.
Yeah, and I'm, for sure.
And I don't know that, you know, Lonzo is just such a hard archetype to figure out because you can't tell whether he's the type of, should he be your primary shot creator, or is he just a really, really good secondary ball handler to have? And do you need someone like Drew who can also play both on and off the ball? And it's hard to predict which guy is going to take the ball off the floor to anyone possession or which guy is going to actually start an action on anyone possession. Whereas, right. you know, Bledsoe, I think, is more effective on than off, for sure. Like, yep. he's less of a threat off the ball than Drew Holiday was. So, you know, given all they got for Drew Holiday, I'm not saying the Pelicans were dumb to make that trade. They were very smart to make that trade.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they got a huge haul, and it's going to improve their long-term outlook around, as you said, a 20-year-old Zion Williamson and Brandon Ingram, who just turned 23 in September. Like, they took the long-term approach here, but it did lead to a slight backslide. And I am wondering, especially with Bledsoe, just like, how long is he for New Orleans? Or is he going to be a guy who, once we get closer to the trade deadline, you know, is he going to be available to the highest bidder?
Oh, he is available. The question is, who would trade for him?
Yeah, or how much would they get back for him?
Right. I mean, I was tinkering with some sort of Eric Bledsoe for Gary Harris kind of trade at some point. Mm-hmm. But, like, mm-hmm. I don't even know how I want that if I'm Denver. Like, to what end?
The Clippers, maybe?
Yeah, back where it all started.
Yeah, well, and because they've, you know, they've long wanted a point guard. But I don't know. I mean, they can't do Kennard because he's poison pill. You're obviously not getting Paul George.
I wouldn't even do Kennard.
Yeah. I mean, it would probably have to be Marcus Morris as the big salary piece, and then a pick, or I don't think you want to give up Zubac in that deal.
No, but look, if they're not going to use him,
like, yeah,
that's obviously a topic for a different day. But what the hell, Clippers?
Yeah, I mean,
so they might as well.
Who else could use? Yeah, I mean,
no, but I wonder if Eric Bledsoe is even that expensive to get.
That's a fair question.
He's 31.
Yeah, I mean, if they're taking back Marcus Morris on the first year of a four-year deal, I think the Clippers would have to give up something more, just because that's probably a contract that the Pelicans aren't psyched to take on.
Yep.
What about the Magic, maybe? Now that Fultz is out?
Yeah, I would agree. That could be a pretty good landing spot, because like Cole Anthony, even though I want to see him get more minutes there, and he's going to, it does seem like he's not quite ready. So why not just get a veteran point guard in there? Yeah, you know, we were talking about on the past episode that the Magic really right now should do everything in their power to keep that momentum up. And as we see, like, they lost three straight, and I'm pretty sure it was like pretty horrid losses, right? One by 42, one by 14, one by 22. Granted, that's a result of having lost Fultz as well. So I'm not saying that's not, you know, that doesn't play in. But like the last time we spoke as well, like Terrence Ross was at 21 points a game. Now he's at 16 and a half. You know, things move quickly in the NBA, Brian. And so you're right. Like maybe getting a guy like Eric Bledsoe in there could stop the bleeding.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, I mean, the Clippers, I guess they could. I don't know if they'd want to give up Beverly. They could do like Beverly and Lou Williams, but that feels pretty steep.
I mean, Lou hasn't been good this year outside of him waking up in the Chicago game, I feel.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I wonder if they'd have to get back, like, maybe they get back Josh Hart as well or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it just feels like the Pelicans are very much in this transition year. Mm-hmm. And I think we should have expected that, given how good Drew Holiday is. Like, the Pelicans, even though they brought in Bledsoe, they brought in Steven Adams.
Are you saying we didn't expect this?
I think I expected them to be
worse.
Definitely worse than they were last year. But I thought it's early, so they're still technically very much in the play-in picture. They're only a half game out. But you know, I thought they'd be more comfortably in that 8-9-10 tier, and I just don't get that feeling yet from them.
Yeah, no, I didn't expect much from them. Because
oh, interesting. Okay.
Like no, not saying that I expected them to be, you know, one of the worst teams in the league or anything. No.
right.
Like they still have Zion Williamson and Brandon Ingram. Like that's not nothing. But I definitely expected their baseline to be much lower this year. I knew coming into this season after having given up Drew Holiday that you're looking at, you know, the long term view here, because they still have all the draft picks most of the draft picks from the Anthony Davis trade. They drafted a 19-year-old Kyra Lewis. Like, this was a pivot towards, you know, the next step, the next 5 years. This wasn't about this year. This is about the next 5 years. And as such, I just didn't take this season into account as being utterly important for them. So I didn't come in with, oh, they're going to make the playoffs automatically. What I believe I said when we talked about this before the season that I could see them make the playoffs. It wouldn't surprise me if they made the playoffs because they have a ton of talent. But I also wouldn't be surprised to see them outside the playoff picture.
Yeah, and I think that's a good perspective for Pelicans fans to have this year, is that, sure, the playoffs would be great, but it's more important to see guys like B.I., who's been great this year.
Yeah.
You know, zero concern about him and the max that he got, 24.7 rebounds, almost 6 assists a game, you know, knocking down 2.2 threes, zero concern with Brandon Ingram. But seeing him, Zion, Lonzo, and some of these younger guys, Alexander Walker, Jackson Hayes, Kira Lewis, seeing them get more involved, stretch their games a little bit, because, you know, as you said, J.J. Redick is not been shooting all that well this year, but he's also 36. Like, by the time you're actually good, J.J. Redick is going to be long retired. So, you know, it's definitely, you want to see the young guys really start to take off, regardless of wins and losses this year. But I can understand, I think there is some palpable frustration from some Pelicans fans that I've seen so far.
Oh, were you just snitch-tacking Mason Ginsburg on the pod?
No, I think he and his podcast co-host Shamit Dua have actually had the right perspective about this year, but some other Pelicans folks do seem to, like, after every loss, I've just seen, like, what is Stan Van Gundy doing? Why, you know?
Oh, I know who you're. No. Yeah, look, I blocked him long ago. I know what you're.
So just keep the perspective in mind that Pelicans, you're gonna be good for a while, and trading Drew is gonna be a step back. But again, it's early. Like, if JJ Redick stops shooting 31.7% overall, if he goes back to his career. Even, you know, not saying he's going to shoot 40 plus from three again, but even as he starts shooting in the high 30s instead of 29.5 from three, all of a sudden we're talking about a very different Pelicans team here. Same thing with Lonzo. If he's not shooting 39.4 overall, 30.8 from three, you know, knock down a couple more buckets a game. And this is, again, it's the peril of small sample size theater here. But I do think it was worth addressing there. Early season malaise because, well, and here's the best strategy for the Pelicans. Just hope one of your opponents gets COVID, wipes out half the team, and there you go. The NBA is probably not going to cancel the game anyway. You'll get fat on some zombie teams.
Yeah. You're not wrong. By the way, unleash Kyra Lewis. I understand he's a rookie, but 13 minutes played for the season. Give me a break.
No. Well, they have a six-game road trip. Clippers, Lakers, Kings, two against Utah and Minnesota.
He's not going to get unleashed.
No, I think, well, we'll learn a lot more about the Pelicans in the next week and a half, assuming the season doesn't get canceled. But we will see what happens. Hopefully we'll get some news in the next day or two about the state of the NBA. But until then, thank you all, as always, for following. Please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bios, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We are being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. And thank you for listening to our live show on Locker Room. If you liked our show, please be sure to start your own room and engage with other fans on the app. Download the Locker Room app in the Apple App Store to be a part of our podcast. Also, a reminder, we are being supported by Manscaped. So use the code NBAPOD, that is NBAPOD, to get 20% off and free shipping at manscaped.com. As always, I'm Brian Toporek. And I was joined by Morten Jensen. Mort, have a good one, my friend.
You too, man. Don't die.